Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, you don't tend to think of artists as soldiers, or at least of art as a weapon of war. But it turns out there was a little-known Army special unit comprised of artists and advertisers and PR professionals and writers who waged a unique kind of misinformation and deception campaign against the Germans in World War II. The Ghost Army of World War II is a book about them by my guest, Rick Beyer, and his co-author, Elizabeth Sales. It was published a few years ago and tells the story of this top-secret unit that used inflatable tanks and planes and sound effects and illusion to fool the Germans on the battlefields of Europe. So because of the secrecy of their mission, the Ghost Army has received little official recognition for a long, long time, and as the members of the unit have aged and passed on, this effort was becoming more urgent. So Rick led a campaign to bring greater recognition to this unusual military group, and his efforts resulted in a bill in Congress to award the Ghost Army the Congressional Gold Medal. And in January 2022, that bill, the Ghost Army Congressional Gold Medal Act, finally finished winding its way through a Congress that rarely agrees on anything and was passed and signed by the president on February 2nd of 2022. So welcome, Rick.
It's great to be here, Court. Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you on, and congratulations to you on finally achieving your goal and getting recognition for the Ghost Army.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, that's a very long effort, as you pointed out, and you don't have to be a cynic to understand that Congress has a lot of areas that they disagree on, and to try to wrangle a few hundred congressmen and senators to support a bill, that's an effort for sure.
On anything, but I think this is something it'd be hard to really turn up your nose or put your hand down on because it's so appealing. So why don't you tell us who the people in the Ghost Army were, Rick, and what did they do?
Well, so first of all, I'm going to go for a nomenclature thing. When I talk about the Ghost Army, I am generally focused on a unit that was called the 23rd Headquarters Special Troops, which is a super boring name for a really interesting unit of about 1,000 men, 1,100 men, who were tasked with deceiving the Germans on the battlefield, actually in France and Luxembourg and Belgium and Germany, and trying to make it seem like American troops were in one place when they were, in fact, someplace completely else or doing something completely different. So to fool the Germans, they had a multimedia approach. So they had inflatable dummies. I think that's the part that everybody always most interested in or most focused on. Inflatable tanks, trucks, airplanes, etc. But they also did sound effects. They also did radio trickery. They also did impersonation, and we can talk about this, where they physically impersonated, say, a specific unit that they were pretending to be. And using all these means of deception, they carried out about 22 different battlefield deceptions. Now, the soldiers who were in the unit were kind of an interesting mix of people. So there were a bunch of artists who had been recruited first for camouflage and then put into this deception unit. You also had engineers. You had people from the telephone company. You had some people from Hollywood, not actually that many, but a few. And you had regular draftees. You had folks who were truck drivers or policemen or cooks or whatever who had been drafted and who were put into this unit. And together, they kind of had to learn to work together to put on a traveling roadshow of deception to fool the Germans, probably a mission that not a single one of them would have expected on the day that Pearl Harbor happened.
That's wild. So it was like a multimedia theatrical production, very broad scale and kind of
it really is.
And flexible.
I really think that the best way to think of this unit is literally as a traveling roadshow, a company of actors and technicians, et cetera, who've come into town. They set up, they do the show, they pack up, and they can move on, and they can be in the next town the following night or a week later, putting on maybe a different show, putting on not the same show, but a slightly different show, and able to do this kind of time after time. And the scale of it is quite large. I was looking at the area of one particular deception. It was about 10 miles by 15 miles or 20 miles. And if you think about that, that's suddenly we're talking about something that's 300 square miles. That's your stage, or if you want to look at it in art terms, that's your canvas and your audience. Think about your audience here, Court. There are a bunch of people who want to kill you, and they don't want to believe anything you have to say. So you have to be really, really convincing in order to make them buy what you're selling. So it's a very interesting story.
Yeah, it's like the size of a small county. And And you can't really fight back with an inflatable tank that's basically a balloon and you're being shot at with real artillery. That's
right. And they had sidearms. They had most of them carried carbines as opposed to M1s because a carbine's lighter. And so if you have work to do, you know, they're all soldiers who've gone through basic training, but they have very little in the way of heavier arms, a few 50 sure. cal machine guns, maybe a bazooka or two. They are not really able to withstand a real attack if it happens.
Mm, sure. Are there any members of this unit whose names we might know?
Well, absolutely. Because there were so many artists that were recruited basically from art schools and places like that, there were some artists who went on to become quite well known. And probably the best known is Bill Blass, the fashion designer. Because you have to be of a certain age to know who Bill Blass is. So, because he was very famous in the 70s and 80s, and a little less so now. But he was in this unit. So was Ellsworth Kelly, who was a very famous minimalist painter and sculptor who was awarded a Presidential Medal of Freedom by Barack Obama. Also, anybody who's a birder might know Arthur Singer's work. He illustrated the book Birds of North America and also did the Birds and Flowers of the 50 States postage stamp series. So you have some pretty well-known people there. And, you know, down Tennessee way, there was an artist named Michael Cagle who became very known as sort of the person who brought modern art to Tennessee. He was in this unit. In fact, he's somebody I didn't know anything about until about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And suddenly we discovered him. And so that's been a very interesting story that I've been taking a look at.
In what battles or fronts did they operate? I mean, were they involved in the Battle of the Bulge and some of those big operations that we know about today?
So they were involved starting in Normandy, not D-Day, though some of them landed right around D-Day. But their first real deception comes about 8 days after D-Day. They're involved in Normandy. They're involved in the fighting on the Brittany Peninsula. They're involved when Patton is racing across France and trying to attack the Germans along the Moselle River. The Ghost Army's there holding a weak spot in his line. During the Battle of the Bulge, they are also helping out General Patton as he's trying to move towards Bastogne, and they're trying to make it seem like he's pushing in a different direction. And they're involved in the crossing of the Rhine River as well in March 1945. They are essentially involved in almost all of the major campaigns that take place in Northern Europe during World War II. I mean, there are five campaigns, and almost everybody in the Ghost Army has five battle stars for those campaigns. I mean, they were there where the action was from, you know, a week after the Normandy invasion until a few weeks before the German surrender. So they really cover the entire scene of fighting there.
That's really wild. It is amazing that people haven't heard of them.
And they're in all these places. And for years, nobody knew anything about
it. That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the history books are written and they don't even mention the Ghost Army. And then when you're trying to tell people about it or trying to kind of write the record now, they're like, well, how come they're not in, you know, so-and-so's memoirs?
Right.
How come they're not in such and such a book?
Right.
And it's because it was secret and they didn't know about it. And so it's almost like trying to change the way history is interpreted is like trying to turn a super tanker around. It's a very slow process.
They were ghosted and you were trying to unghost them and you did it.
Well put, yeah.
Tell us some more about some of the deception and illusion techniques that they used, Rick. Did they mislead German spies? I mean, you know, were they just trying to trick the forward troops with, you know, with telescopes and binoculars? Or were they trying to trick people who were really intelligent about this kind of thing?
Well, so if you think about deception, it's good to take a step back. And, you know, a successful deception is built on understanding how your enemy gathers information, what channels they use, if you want to think of it that way. And then you're trying to come up with a false story, and you're sort of trying to flood the different channels and put it out there so that whatever way the enemy is gathering information is going to point them towards the story that you're trying to sell them. And one more thing about that is think about this from a psychology point of view. You don't want to be too obvious about it, right? Hmm. You're leaving some clues, and depending on them to kind of put together the clues, so they will go, aha, I have carefully figured out from the stuff that we've been able to glean, you know, what the enemy is up to. But of course, it's entirely wrong. So they really are, you know, so they're doing the tanks and trucks, et cetera, to try to fool enemy aerial reconnaissance. They're doing sound to fool enemy observation posts. They're doing radio deception, creating phony radio networks so that when the enemy's got people listening in on radios, they say, oh, I hear this new unit coming on. It's moving. We're plotting it on a map. We can sort of see what it's doing. And then possibly the most interesting type of deception they did, they called special effects. And special effects involved literally kind of impersonating American soldiers to fool enemy spies who had been left behind. Because keep in mind, the front is moving towards Germany. The closer you get to Germany and get inside Germany, the more Germans there are going to be who might be slinking around, gathering information, you know, forwarding it to the German army. So if they were impersonating, let's say, the 75th Infantry Division, they would put on patches for the 75th Infantry Division, usually counterfeit patches because they couldn't get the real ones fast enough. They would drive around in trucks with 75th Infantry Division markings on them, put two guys in the back of one of those deuce and a half trucks, and it looks like the whole truck is full, but it's really not. And you're driving back and forth doing that. And then they would set up a phony regimental headquarters. They'd have some captain in the unit pretending to be a colonel or a general, you know, driving up in his Jeep with the markings of a two-star general, bodyguards, etc. Again, so that any enemy spies would report this information. Obviously, you know, impersonating generals is kind of against army regulations. They had to get special permission to do that. But that was the extent that they went. I mean, when you think about deception, it's like putting on a show. You have to be all in and you have to pay attention to the details. If you think about it, Court, like if you want to fool enemy aerial reconnaissance, and so you say, I'm going to put up some inflatable tanks and I'm going to kind of hide them in the trees a little bit so parts of them are sticking out. But if you don't think about putting tank tracks leading up to where your inflatable tank is, it's going to be obvious that it's a fake. So now you have to have, and you're doing this at night, so now you have to have somebody in a bulldozer who's sitting there carefully making tracks up to each place where you're inflating an inflatable tank. And when you think about that, then you start to say, oh, okay, this is a pretty complex effort. There's a lot of thinking that has to go into it. It's not easy to do. It's like pulling off a giant magic trick. And we have to make every detail work or somebody will see through the trick and then they won't believe anything else you do either.
Wow, it's really complicated. I mean, I think some of them were theater set designers. And so did the Ghost Army, you know, actually build some of the deceptive scenes themselves from scratch and put up a whole set?
Yeah, well, not really exactly like you would think. I mean, they had a couple of people who did go into set design. I'm not sure how much they were really set designers beforehand. You know, they're given the tools of these inflatable tanks, but then it's kind of what they do with them. So, or let's say inflatable artillery. You have an inflatable artillery piece. You want to make it look real to the enemy. So you have to, first of all, you have to create the revetment, right? The place where the artillery piece would be dug in, sandbags around it, etc. You have to discard some used shells around it so it looks like it's been firing. You have to put netting over it to simulate the way it would have been done in reality. So in that sense, they're building up their deceptions themselves. But they're not like creating phony towns or something like that. That's just that is not kind of part of the brief of what they did.
So who actually built these inflatable tanks and other large things like artillery pieces?
Well, they were created by rubber companies in the United States by a consortium of rubber companies. They were designed by a guy named Fred Patton, who worked at the U.S. rubber factory in Woonsocket, Rhode Island, spelled differently than General George Patton and not related. But then they kind of contracted out to all these different rubber factories. There was one in Scranton, Pennsylvania. You had one in Columbus, Ohio, one in Memphis, Tennessee, a couple in New England. And they're all making the tanks or and the other inflatables or making parts of them, which may sound kind of funny. But these vehicles are built on a skeleton of inflatable tubing. So one company just made the inflatable tubing. That's all they did. They didn't. And then they shipped it out to other places to assemble. And I got a chance to talk to one of the workers who was at the time, she was a 16-year-old girl named Teresa Ricard. She was a little bit older when I talked to her. Working at the U.S. rubber plant in Woonsocket, Rhode Island. And she was told, and the other workers were told, that these were, they were targets for target practice. So this was kind of a way of keeping security, right? Because you're not telling them that they're being used for deception. But she worked on these tanks. She was 16 years old. She made 49 cents an hour. And that was her contribution to the war effort.
Hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask you, how did they keep secret with all these different facilities building them? But you just answered that question. So,
well, yeah. And I mean, it's a part of a huge, huge war effort. And again, if one place is making the tubing and one place is doing something else, there may be a small number of people who actually kind of know what the final product is.
And, that's right. Yeah.
And an even smaller number of people who know what it's going to be used for.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with my guest, Rick Beyer, about the story he's really blown life into, the Ghost Army of World War II.
Oh, good pun there.
Right? A secret unit that really played a very effective role on the front lines in World War II in Europe against the Germans and deceiving the German military into thinking things were going on that weren't really going on. But that kind of gets us back to the question, Rick, of, you know, did they ever engage in actual firefights? Because we talked about the fact that they really weren't set up for even barely for defensive action, much less anything offensive. I mean, were they ever overrun or did they ever, you know, really seriously draw fire and get attacked? And what happened to them when they did?
Yeah, they did seriously draw fire. I mean, that was their job. It's like, hey, shoot at me. And they did 22 different deceptions, and some of them are closer to the front than others. But I think they probably drew enemy fire in 8 or 9 of those deceptions, primarily artillery fire. And it took a toll. I mean, they had 4 people who were killed during the war. They had several dozen who were seriously injured. So, I mean, it could have been a lot worse. I don't want to overstate that, given the circumstances. But, you know, this was not a kind of a, you know, sometimes we have a tendency to view this as a, oh, it's a whimsical story. It's kind of like it plays against type, against the horrors of World War II. We have this kind of more fun tale, and it is. And the guys would agree with that. But it was something that people were also killed doing, and people were badly wounded doing. People suffered a frostbite or traumatic injuries that left them, you know, badly injured after the war. And, you know, we've researched a lot of that. And so it was not kind of a scot-free, you know, happy-go-lucky mission.
It wasn't all fun and games, but it must have been fun sometimes because it was so unusual.
Yes.
So, I mean, are you, you must know some particularly interesting or funny stories about things that might have happened.
I know many of them, and we don't have time for them all today, but I'll tell you one or two.
Okay.
That one of my favorite stories involves this effort to impersonate officers. And so in March 1945, as part of a deception called Operation Viersen, they wanted to make it seem like the 119th Regiment was in a certain place. And so they've got a headquarters building there. It's actually still there. It's a restaurant in Dulken, Germany. And there was a captain named George Reb. He was probably 24 at the time. And he is pretending to be a colonel commanding this regiment. And I don't know if people aren't terribly familiar with the military. It's only a couple of ranks different between captain and colonel. But colonel is a senior officer and captain is a junior officer. It's a big difference.
Right.
But they've got this phony headquarters. It's got the markings. It's got wires coming into it as if it's got communication everywhere. And this is a couple of other American officers who are trying to find their way to where they're supposed to be going, stop at this headquarters and go in to kind of ask directions. And they know George Reb because they were at West Point with George Reb. And they can't figure out. He was actually younger than them. He was two classes behind them. But they're still captains and he's a colonel.
Who did he know?
and he's not supposed to say why, you know, what's going on. You're supposed to keep operational security even with other American forces.
That's right.
And so, and they don't want to ask him because they are like bewildered and mystified and don't want to embarrass themselves. But they manage to corner his sergeant as they're leaving. And they say, how the hell did Reb get to be a colonel? And the sergeant just shrugs his shoulders and says, fortunes of war. Right. And George Reb told me that story himself, and he still got a chuckle. He did, in fact, go on to become a major general in the U.S. Army and had a very distinguished career. But, you know, that was a promotion. That was his early promotion to colonel, but not a real one. He still was a captain at the end of the day. But there's a ton of stories. Do you have time for one more?
Sure. Quick one. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, there were a case where they were setting up the inflatable tanks and a couple of Frenchmen spotted them setting up one of these inflatables. And the guard, Arthur Shilstone, is trying to push these Frenchmen away so that they won't, you know, sort of see what's going on here. And all they can do is they look over his shoulder, and what they thought they saw was four GIs lifting up a 40-ton Sherman tank. And they look at Arthur Shilstone, who's on guard duty, and they're like, what's going on? And he just says, the Americans are very strong. and tries to get rid of it that way. I also think at that point they probably took those guys into custody and didn't let them out for a few days. But yeah, there's a lot of funny stories, but it is a serious business.
Yeah. Well, there was a PBS documentary about them in 2013, which I think you directed, right?
I did direct it. I did, yeah.
So and you've been on this for a while. Seriously, on this.
I have been working on telling this story for 17 years.
Wow.
And my joke is that I'm going to put in my 20 and then I'm going to retire. So, but I think we're getting near, I think I'm getting near the end of the cycle.
Well, I wonder, if, I hope you'll get some kind of a congressional medal out of it, but I kind of doubt it, right? Yeah,
I did get a medal. I got a medal from a French veterans organization. I don't have too many circumstances where I get to wear it, but I do have a, they pinned it on me and, you know, kissed both cheeks. It was quite a ceremony over in France. So
that's cool.
I have another medal from a town in Treviere, Normandy, but I like to focus the attention on the soldiers. They're the ones who fought the war and did the stuff. And I think they deserve the credit and the attention.
Well, I think, you know, a few years back, I saw, you know, online that there was a Hollywood film in the works about this subject. It was starring Bradley Cooper at the time. Did that go anywhere or where does that stand? Is it just on a shelf somewhere?
Well, you know, there's a thousand ways a movie can die. And there was a bit of a journey there. And I can't tell you everything about it, but there was an effort to make a film with Andrew Lazar was the producer. He produced American Sniper, among other movies, among many other movies. They had a deal. At first, it was supposed to be Bradley Cooper. A screenplay was written. A second revised screenplay was written. Then Bradley Cooper wasn't involved anymore. Then Ben Affleck was going to star and direct in it. And I honestly thought there was a point a few years ago, I thought they were talking about casting and budget, and I thought this was happening. And then in the way of Hollywood, it unhappened, you know, it fell apart. Mm-hmm. That was just before COVID, and there have been a few stirrings since then, so it could come back. My story about this is that it's not dead, it's just mostly dead, you know, which means it's a little bit alive. And so we'll have to see where that goes. I still think it would be a terrific, terrific Hollywood film. I do think it will happen someday. I don't know, you know, whether it'll be film or series or when that'll happen, but it's just too good a story for it not to happen.
Really? I mean, it's so visual and so, you know, it's just automatically cinematic, you would think. But like you said, in Hollywood, a lot of trial balloons get lofted and then they lose their air. We're sticking with the inflatables.
And I looked around I looked around my office, Court, and I don't see any Academy Awards here. So I figured that the people who know how to make movies, they have to find a way that it works for them. And so we hope that that happens someday. And I'm not really doing anything to try to make it happen, but I'm very receptive to anybody who calls or emails who wants to talk about that.
There you go. Hope somebody out there is listening. Well, listen, let's, you know, we're getting toward the last few minutes of the show, so let's talk about the Congressional Gold Medal and your push to have it awarded to the members of the unit. And so when did you first start? I mean, 17 years ago? You know, just tell us kind of quickly.
I started telling the story 17 years ago. That's when I started working on the documentary. We started working on the gold medal 7 years ago. And when I say we, there was a bunch of people who were involved over that period of time, probably 30 to 40 people in the end, including... We had some great teenage lobbyists who had become fascinated by the story. But a Congressional Gold Medal the first one was awarded to George Washington, which gives you an idea of kind of the standards here. And I think there's been, 180 of them awarded over 250 years. So it's a very high honor. It's Congress's highest award for achievement, national achievement. And so we set out to make this happen. But to get Congress to pass a gold medal is very challenging because, unlike almost any other piece of legislation, you have to have two-thirds of the House and two-thirds of the Senate co-sponsor the bill before it can even get a vote. So in essence, you have to say there's overwhelming support for this before you can even bring it to the floor. So that's why it was a 7-year effort, and we literally had to convince something on the order of 350 congressmen and senators to put their names on this bill. And so it was a lot of lobbying and a lot of effort. And you might say, oh, well, it's just a no-brainer. But for every one of these guys, they wanted to check it out. They wanted to make sure that it was really worthwhile. They wanted to make sure there wasn't something else that was more worthwhile. There was a lot of stuff that went into that. But we did manage to convince Congress, and it was passed, as you mentioned, it was passed actually passed the Senate in December of 2021 and the House final passage in January of 2022. And it was a very exciting day for me on February 1st. When President Biden signed that bill into law. You know, there's no metal yet because it takes a while for the Mint to design the metal. That's a process. We're involved in review and feedback on that, but it'll probably be another year before there's an actual metal. But we've been doing ceremonies for the surviving soldiers to honor them and to kind of make them understand what a big deal it is. There's about 10 Ghost Army soldiers who are still alive. And so we've been doing a gold medal ceremony for each one. I'm working right now on planning the one that's going to be for a veteran in Kentucky coming up in about a month. So we're almost done with those ceremonies. And so that's really, I've been spending a lot of time on that this year.
Well, just quickly, does the award come to the surviving members individually or to the unit as a whole?
The award is a collective award to the unit. Congress will passes the bill. The Mint will eventually make a gold medal, a single gold medal with gold in it, and they'll give that to the Smithsonian, and then they will sell duplicate bronze medals. So the award is collectively to the unit. It's not like somebody's pinning a medal on each of the individual soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we're still trying to make them feel really good about it.
That's great. Yeah, I understand that one surviving member named Manny Frocht, who lives in Palm Beach County, Florida, was honored, by the local officials and so on in early August for it.
Yeah, we'd had a ceremony for Manny down in West Palm Beach, and the local congressman, Brian Mast, was there, made a very moving speech. And Brian Mast himself is a Army veteran who lost both his legs to an IED in Afghanistan.
Wow.
And it was a very moving moment there when he was honoring Manny Frocht and honoring the unit. And I thought he had a keen understanding of coming from his Army experience of the importance of a unit like this and the potential dangers of being in a unit like this. And so I really appreciated what he had to say.
Well, Rick, we really appreciate your determination in sticking with this and bringing it all together and into fruition after all these years, but we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time, but the website is www.ghostarmy.org, ghostarmy.org, and that redirects you to the website of the Ghost Army Legacy Project, which Rick runs, and there you can watch a video about the gold medal celebration that Rick produced and see a lot of information about the unit, and I think you can buy Rick's book, The Ghost Army of World War II, on Amazon, or you can listen to the audiobooks version, I think, on audible.com. And, you can download or rent the PBS documentary that he did a while back from iTunes or Netflix or Amazon.
I would add that we also do a Ghost Army tour. So people who are interested in following in the route of the Ghost Army can go to the tour page of Stephen Ambrose Historical Tours and discover the Ghost Army tour, which is a great way to learn about the unit.
Well, Rick, thanks again so much for being on to tell us the story of the Ghost Army. Very interesting.
Thank you so much, Court. Appreciate it.
And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again, same time, same place next week, for more American Variety Radio.